Welcome to Season 2 of Beyond the Wall, a Game of Thrones LCG podcast brought to you by Istral and Darknotch. We'd like to thank FFG and CardGameDB for their continued support, and the fantastic AGOT community as a whole for being the sole reason we do this cast. Thank you for letting us take you once again beyond the wall.
Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. Today we're going to have a quick intro, then we're going to have some post-Gen Con news. Then Alex and I are going to talk about our Gen Con, after which we're going to be joined by DC Aaron to talk about his Gen Con. And he took second place in the Joust, second overall, and was one of the masterminds behind the DC pit deck, which won it all. And then finally we're going to have some closing comments.
Episode 27, John. What is this episode?
It's the episode of Gen Con.
That was spelled with an A. I could tell. This is the post the post Gen Con episode. This is we had a break, so we didn't bring you an episode last week. So this is.
It's going to run long too.
It's going to run long, obviously. There's also a ton of news to go over, and we won't be able to go over all of it in that much meticulous depth this week. I'm sure we'll have lots of time to cover a lot of the 2.0 over the next couple of weeks. But for those of you who didn't know, last weekend was Gen Con, or by the time you're listening to this, two weekends ago, I guess. But the sort of last weekend of July, first weekend of August, so the first and second of August, was Gen Con, which they call the best 4 days in gaming, an appropriate name. It was record attendees, 68,000 people this year, 68,000 different people, not necessarily all in the rooms at the same time. The launch of Game of Thrones 2.0, it was the final North American Joust Championships and Melee Championships for 1.0. There was a lot of other FFG stuff as well. There was a lot of coverage for some other groups. I think we should at least touch on some of that. But I maybe would like to start with the non-Gen Con news. FFG announced a couple of things while we were at Gen Con that they just posted to their front page, like the second chapter pack for the first cycle of second edition.
That's exciting.
You don't sound convinced.
I am convinced. It's exciting, but at the same time, I'm still a little sad that 1.0 is leaving and that I'm not going to get to play 2.0 to almost like, you know, 6-7 months from now.
Why is that?
In a competitive environment.
Oh, okay, I see. Yeah, because regionals.
I have to wait for store. Yeah, exactly. I got to wait for store championships and regionals. And, you know, I don't know if you know about this, me, Alex, but I really like Thrones and I like to play a lot. So not having something, a goal to push towards like that is a little saddening. So that's what, when I hear the 2.0 news, it's kind of happy and sad at the same time.
I did see that they were reprinting The Reader, which was kind of an interesting card to come back. I'm sure Greyjoy fans like myself will be quite happy to see that, and I'm sure that Marty José Hernández will be happy to see his card coming back so early into the game. Other non-necessarily Gen Con news, there's a lot of 2.0 related stuff, like the deck builders. There are four different deck builders up for 2.0, for those of you who are interested. In fact, as of, I think, the day that we're actually recording this, the one on CardGameDB exports to Octagon now, which is a huge addition for us who tend to play on Octagon a fair bit right now, especially since many of you don't have the cores yet. That's your only option for playing.
I'm amazed that FFG allows that, to be honest, because they own that site and they're supporting basically people making money off their game.
I know you mentioned some of this at Gen Con, but maybe you should go into it very briefly here, because it surprised me to hear what you were saying.
What, that, you know, a large percentage of the Octagon people actually subscribe and pay $3 a month?
No, but also that there were individual subscriptions for some of the games, like premium subscriptions direct to the developers. So it wasn't just the people maintaining Octagon, but the individual modules, which starts to be a
some
lot.
Some of the module owners ask for donations, and when you do get donations, or if you're a subscriber to Octagon, you get special features as well. So if you're a subscriber or you donate, you can get sound in some of these modules, or little effects or hotkeys that wouldn't be available normally. And that's just kind of an incentive to subscribe to Octagon and or send some coffee money to the people maintaining these modules. But, you know, if everyone, if you have a couple thousand people sending coffee money every month, that can be a decent chunk of change.
Well, it's not just that. I mean, maintaining Octagon as a platform, you could say, is for a lot of other games and a lot of things and so on. But as the developer of the module for Game of Thrones or whatever the case is, clearly you're making money off the IP. If you're given any money whatsoever. And that's where I think that FFG must have a problem with it. You can always argue that Octagon is making money off the platform if they're making money. But making really? Money off – well, you can. That doesn't necessarily mean it's true.
Okay. They're definitely making money off all the different card game IPs. Now they have a ton of them, right? They probably have 30 or 40 different card games, everything from Magic to Game of Thrones. And, you know, I'm sure the money they're making from FFG related is probably a drop in the bucket compared to some of their other stuff like Vanguard or Magic.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, I think that is something to keep in mind. I am surprised that FFG tolerates it. I'm glad they do. I think we should, you know, not push the boundaries too far. You know, if you're streaming, stream with the censored cards if you can, that kind of thing. I play with the censored cards. There aren't that many for me to memorize, and you can always right-click on them to show the text. But I wouldn't push our luck. I think that this is the kind of thing that if they're happy to see the community grow. Nobody else has access to their cores if you weren't at Gen Con, so this is your only way to play. But I wouldn't flaunt it too much. There's not much FFG can do but get angry. But even getting angry is going to cause us problems.
Well, you think they could actually go to Octagon, the guys running Octagon, and say, you will not allow people to play the following modules.
They probably could, yeah. I mean, this has been an age-old debate, and we've mentioned it in the past, on the fine line we tread with Octagon and whether it's allowed. It'd be really nice if FFG would be clear. You know, some of the games have the text box censored. Some of the games have the art censored. Some of them
have nothing.
For one period, some of them for not. And so it's very hard to walk a line when you don't know where it exists. But we know we're towing that line with Octagon. And if we want to keep it, we want to not push our luck.
FFG, just come out with your own online platform to play the card games already.
Yep. That would be the solution. There'd be the guilt-free, easy, they can make some money off us way to legitimately play the game.
I'll send you $5 or something a month to play your games online. Not a problem.
I will scan my chapter packs or whatever it is, if that's what you want.
Yeah, whatever you need, I will do it.
not to take anything away from those who have put considerable amount of time in getting this Octagon module ready.
Yes,
basically,
and it's
launch
great.
Day, lots of people are playing. You can turn on Octagon and see 20 Game of Thrones games, which is something we haven't seen in a long, long time. That is fantastic news. But, you know, we all know that we're sort of either being ignored or barely tolerated, and that's not necessarily a very pleasant feeling. Gen Con stuff in general, because I do have a bunch of it. Obviously, the launch of 2.0 means that CardGameDB now has reviews for the core set going up. Team Covenant was at Gen Con. They did video reviews live at Gen Con of the core and a bunch of other stuff as well. Team Covenant's also a great place if you want to go look at the in-flight report, which was FFG's sort of summary of the last year and sort of a retrospective of 20 years because it was their 20th anniversary and their 19th Gen Con. So interesting historical perspective. Not a ton of Thrones information in there. I think one Throne slide and nothing you didn't know already. But if you didn't know the history of the company and the stuff, there was certainly some information to be had in that in-flight report. Gen Con also served as the launch a new series of playmats for 2.0. There's now an article online announcing that they're selling two sort of demo playmats with specific areas for your deck and discard pile so you can remember that kind of thing. Did you see that, John?
Oh. Yeah, I don't like that.
See, that's kind of – I really like the idea. I hope this goes out with demo kits, for instance. I love that as it gives them a sort of thematic surface to play on, and it helps teach them where certain things are and what important elements are. That's fine. But I can't see myself buying one.
What's with all the dead space on it? Like, this is where you put your plot. This is where you put your characters, your locations, blah, blah, blah. And this is the dead space at the top.
At the top for the art. These were the ones they were demoing, or the Danny ones were the ones they were using for demos at Gen Con. And I asked them about getting some to teach. However, they did also at Gen Con have a series of playmats that were absolutely gorgeous 2.0 ones. They featured art, one for each faction. So there were eight of them, very vibrant colors, very, very nice, but really nice touches in that the sort of what would otherwise be dead space on the right of each of them was very well textured. So the Stark one is a picture of ice, the Michael Cormack art, where with the sort of red leaves from the heart tree, and he's cleaning up ice from the card art ice in second edition as well. But the part on the right where they have this sort of Stark color is textured like direwolf fur. So you look at it and it really is this fur, while the Targaryen version is scales and looks really nice there too. I think they did a phenomenal job with that first print run of Gen Con release playmats, which was not something that they had announced. I think it's something that sold very well, that a lot of people were happy to see, and a lot of people were playing with them during the Kingslayer.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, just too much dead space on that playmat.
Too much dead space. Gen Con stats, we're going to talk about the tournament. Obviously, you tend to come to the annals for stats. I have full standings. I do not have the house and agenda for everyone yet. I'm beginning to fill that out now that I'm recovered from a Gen Con illness. But the information I should be getting from FFG once they get over their, you know, Gen Con aftermath as well, which I'm sure takes them longer to recover from than it takes me. There's one final piece of news I had, John, and this is
It's a tournament?
No. This is your ex podcast co-host. Your ex podcast ex co-host.
Tiny Grimes.
Tiny Grimes is back.
I saw him. I sat with him. We chatted a bit, and it was great to see him back.
He's announced that he's doing a live stream core set review and some games. I know he's been streaming a lot of other games in the meantime since he sort of set Thrones 1.0 aside. He's coming back to do that. So am I going to lose you to Tiny, John?
No.
Should I be a jealous co-host?
We are co-hosts forever, Alex.
Well, John, this is the Gen Con segment. How was your Gen Con?
It was awesome. It was great seeing everyone. It was great hanging out. And, you know, I can't say how much I think going to that hotel outside of town instead of right in the center of Gen Con is worth it. I think it's just such a cool experience. You lose out on a few things, like being able to go back to your hotel to sleep between rounds or during lunch. But really, I never was able to do that anyways, because I found by the time you walked back 10 minutes and walked back to the con 10 minutes, you really only had 20 minutes in the hotel, so it wasn't worth it. And the bars and the restaurants downtown get so packed from these 36,000 people that are there that you can never...
68,000.
Oh, 68,000. My mistake. 68,000 people. And it gets so packed that you can't get a table, you can't sit as a group, you can't even hear because of all the other conversations and the loud music. I really enjoy the Microtel. You know, it's a $9 Uber ride, so 18 bucks a day. But the price of the room is what you pay for a night. You pay for a week if you get in there earlier. And more importantly, you get all the Thrones community together, and you can have some fun gaming. You can play games in the bar. You can sit down. You can hear each other. I thought that was a huge part of the experience, and I really enjoy it.
See, I was hoping you wouldn't make that plug, because you're the one who initially plugged the Microtel. You're the one who suggested people get there. So I feel like you giving the selling points is sort of like, you know, you were already sold, but I was sold. This is my first year staying in the Microtel. That was awesome. Not because of the Microtel, but because all of the Thrones community was, you know, or not all of them, obviously, but we had a lot of the Thrones community in one place. Even just catching rides with people, which I have to be incredibly thankful for, because of the way Uber is set up, I wound up never paying for a fare, so I owe some people some money. But, you know, just getting into town was easy. We were all coordinating together for that across different metas, playing games, as you said, in the lobby, playing games in the bar, which was right next door. That was amazing, and definitely worth it. Last year or 2 years ago, I stayed outside of the city, sort of closer to the airport, because it was cheaper, and I drove in, and I only had one group of friends, and it was fine, and I told myself, next time, definitely downtown. But you managed to convince me otherwise, and you were right. If you want to go to Gen Con next year, book the Microtel if you're interested in drones. That's the way to do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just so nice to, you know, play a Sheriff of Nottingham game or whatever game. There was a ton of stuff. I learned Mage Wars. I learned Sheriff of Nottingham. I learned something about a yellow egg.
The Dungeon Keeper thing. Anyway, yeah.
lots of games, and it's just fun to hang out and be able to play those games and talk Thrones too, you know, because talk about the Melee the night before, the Joust and the Joust winners. There's karaoke, which makes some people happy. We had a John Bruno sighting with some singing. It was good.
That's right, yeah. Hard Day's Night. I was thinking we might do this a little bit chronologically for those who aren't necessarily familiar with Gen Con. I mean, we both flew in on the Wednesday.
Yeah, we met up and went and got our badges.
The line there was the longest I'd ever seen.
But fast.
It was well managed, and, you know, we won't be describing all the lines.
I think we basically just got our stuff, met up with some people, played a few games, and went to sleep ready for Melee the next day.
Ready for Melee. So what did you bring to Melee, John?
I brought the same thing you did. We both brought the Bera the Maester's Path, basically very similar to the deck that DC would run the next day. It was a little bit of a joke, but also because it was it's a good deck. And it performed very well for me. I went 3-0 in the start of the Melee. I think I was top seed going into the top 16. I might be wrong. There might have been someone 3-0 as well with the higher strength schedule, but I don't think so. And I lost my top 16 game when the table all turned on me in a horrible, horrible way. They wouldn't even trade plots with me turn one.
This was a table with two DC players and Peter Wilson, who wound up taking the table in the end from Montreal.
Actually, Frenchhorn Mikey was there, but...
Well, that's right. Yeah. Sorry, Mikey was there.
A lot of people don't know this about me and Mikey. We used to build a lot together, and we built Melee decks a lot together. That was kind of our thing that we did. And Melee was one of the games that me and Mikey both really, really enjoy, and we're both very competitive at. So I lost to Mikey 2 years ago when he took the Melee Championship.
I think that was three now.
3 years ago? I can't remember.
That was
3 years ago. And ever since then, we've kind of been at odds when we hit a table. So I was basically against Mikey, who we go hard against each other, Peter and the DC, and I think the DC and Peter actually thought that me and Mikey were going to be friendly because we had built together in the past. This Melee, obviously, I built with you, Alex, so I didn't build with Mikey. But yeah, it wasn't like that, so they all just kind of beat me into a hole. It was horrible.
It was horrible. Top 16.
It was a good top 16. I mean, I didn't come last at the table in the end, but still, both Peter and Aaron were higher placing than me at that table. And Peter went on for a top four with the DC crew.
Yeah, the DC final. Before we describe into that final, I'll quickly mention my performance wasn't anywhere near as good. My first table, Corey Faherty dominated the table. I had complete control of my Maesters and, well, everything, really. No one else in the table was... I mean, it was an interesting match, but it was pretty clear that Corey had a dominating presence. He's an excellent player and was able to keep that, threatening the right people at the right time. My second table, Peter Wilson took with his Martel Mill agenda. It was a very, very interesting game. I managed to play a very long Melee game because I lost my Steel Link fairly early on, and I had to set it up just so that it would be the top card of my deck when I needed it. And I got my Threat from the North turn on like turn five, I think it was. But I made a slip, and I left Peter Wilson with an icon he should not have had. And it cost me the game, cost me what was looking like a complete board lockdown to choosing the spear from someone else on one of Peter Wilson's characters. Well, it was the right decision, the way it cemented the board standing. So, but it was a very interesting match. But I was really kicking myself for, you know, having triggered the Brimstone, which we didn't think we were going to need to use, and having triggered it on a couple of characters and then deciding, okay, I had this board under lockdown. Let's just give myself icons. I don't need to win this. It's like, ah, no, that was dumb. But it was a very, very good match. And then my third match was a three-person table, unfortunately, but I was able to lock down a first on that one. So I missed the cut by a reasonable margin. But had a lot of fun with the deck. It had more comeback potential than I initially thought it did in that second match, which was a lot of fun to play.
I won a table where my Maester was killed turn one. So I managed to win the table without any chains. It wasn't an easy win, but it was surprising that the deck still had this nice burst rush that it could pull off with Knight of the Flowers and Bob. So that list is actually posted, and people can take a look at it. It's already up on AGOT Cards, and I'm sure Alex will link it when he posts the cast.
Do you want to give us a rundown of the final table? So we stuck around to watch this final table. Peter Wilson, Corey Faherty, Brian Aurelio, and Seth. Little C. as you come to know him, unfortunately. So that's three DC players, two of whom were playing a Greyjoy Lupin apart. Corey playing a Dothraki, no agenda, with a, well, you know, easy enough to flood the board, some tricks to do big power swings if he wants to ambush from the plains in Jogo, and Incinerates is a good threat on the board. Very, very solid deck. And Peter was playing the Martell No Agenda. It's just really Martell good stuff, running Venomous Blade. Arianna's is restricted. Shadows Arianna's is restricted. So that table was a pretty heated match. Corey looked like he was in a very comfortable position.
Yeah, I mean, Corey could have won it all if Peter hadn't nightmared his Jogo. I think that would have been game. But basically, Peter set up two cards and was out of the running, and it was between the three DC players. And I think Seth is still kicking himself because I think he felt that he could have won, but he played his events that claim power too early, basically. And that forced Corey to incinerate one of his guys on his final challenge to ensure he couldn't take the win. But I think if Seth had not played those power claim events until his final challenge, Corey would have said, oh, there's no way he's going to get four more power, five more power he needs to win. I'll let this go. I won't incinerate his guy. He'll be at, you know, 13 or something or 11. But he played those two events too early. And I think he's mad about them.
Melee is a game of, you know, there's always something you could have done. There are always. You can look back on my matches of something I learned from all of them as well. But, I mean, there was a moment where I felt Corey could have clinched the game even despite that. He may have seen it as well. And in the end, Ryan did. So it really looked like that match could have gone any of three ways at that point. I think Peter needed the game to go longer for him to have any chance of recovery, though.
Yeah. And that wasn't happening with the two rush decks at the table.
But that does put Corey at another final table. Corey, phenomenal player, phenomenal deck builder, as you hopefully all know by now. And that does give DC, through Brian Aurelio, a Melee championship. And I think Brian was saying this is going to be his last tournament for a while because his wife is pregnant. Twins. So he's going to be out of the game for a little while, probably not jumping into 2.0 right away. What a high note to end on. I mean, congratulations, Brian.
Yeah, the last ever Melee U.S. national champion. For 1.0. Yeah, that's a big, that's great. I guess we could talk a little bit about the night. We went back to the Microtel. We played some games.
Yeah, we played some games. There were some drinking games that looked slightly dangerous.
I was smart. I actually, after two rounds of the drinking game, I said, whoa, I can't do this. I'm out.
Wasn't this was Drunk Quest?
This was
a version of Munchkins where you, to do damage, you had to
take drinks.
Take drinks.
And the first monster I fought had a 42 health. So it required 42 drinks. Your average beer had about 12 drinks in it. So, you know, you're looking at 3 to 4 beers to kill that monster. But there was some Sheriff of Nottingham, some people playing 2.0, some people building their joust deck for the next day.
Yeah, there were some people playing their early 2.0 stuff.
I actually remember after Drunk Quest, I was a little intoxicated. And I sat down with some people. I think it was Aaron was asking me advice for someone that was building a deck. So Lauren was building a deck. And I remember looking at the deck and going, oh, my God, you got to change a whole bunch of stuff in my drunken stupor. And I really didn't think about it because she ended up doing really, really well the next day. And I kind of had to eat those drunken words.
You had to eat those drunken words.
Yeah. So I remember leaving going, oh, HOD solar, it's not going to do anything. Going back to my room. We woke up early, though.
We wake up early because we're excited for the joust and we're incapable of sleeping before a big tournament. That's mostly our own. it was early. I still haven't found a good, reliable way to get over the pre-tourney jitters. Someday I will.
Yeah, me neither.
I can't before the tournament. I really can't.
I can't.
No good excuse.
I like a big breakfast. My stomach doesn't get going, but I get going. I'm just excited because I know it's going to be a ton of fun. And I get worried, too, of course. You know, you want to do well. But, yeah, we got there in plenty of time, got ourselves registered, and we both had to play the first round, right?
Yeah, neither of us did a bye this year.
I sadly missed the Ottawa tournament. Sean Emberley took the bye from the Ottawa regional here, and we both performed poorly in Montreal, and that was all the regionals I went to.
Now, I don't think we're going to do a round-by-round, but I guess we should first mention what decks we played. We built slightly differently this year than we have in the past, and maybe you should tell us a little bit about that because you were more heavily involved in it than I was.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to build with a bunch of the New York guys, and if people don't know them, they should. Both Dan and Dave are phenomenal players, and that's not to take away from any of the New York players like Roy or Aaron, but Dan has kind of been, I'll say, a person that creates and defines metas. He was, with Corey, the grandfather of the DC meta. So the two of them really created the DC meta together, and now that he's in New York, he's kind of doing the same thing in New York. He's bringing all those players together. He's helping, providing advice, trying to improve the meta, and I think they're a very competitive meta now, as proven by, Roy getting top 10.
Dan himself.
Dan himself, of course.
Top 8.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the other players that were in that build group just barely missing the cut. They were all 4-2s. So I think it was an extremely strong showing. And actually, Lauren, who I played for to find out if I would go to the cut or not, originally from that New York meta as well. So it's, it was a really nice experience. I went down to New York. I got to hang out with the guys. Had a really good time. We built a bunch of decks. And in the end, I came back and I said, I didn't love any of those decks. And, Alex, you always recommend to me to play something that I'm going to enjoy more than what I think is going to win.
Yeah, only one person is going to win the tournament. And be realistic, it's not going to be you, and it's not going to be me. And if your only goal is to win, then you're only going to enjoy the tournament one out of 100 and something times. So play a deck that you're going to enjoy, even if you lose.
Yeah. So me and Aaron built a deck, 4 or 5 days before the tournament, something that we really enjoyed, the Targ AAA, and that's what we ended up playing. And in fact, I think I switched, which I think was a mistake, actually, the night before I changed the deck. Substantially, I moved from a standard AAA to a summer, and I think it was probably better.
I told you not to.
Yeah, me too. I just wanted to play what Aaron was playing. It was fun. I never ended up using the summer ever.
I do want to mention, so even though, you built with New York and I was involved in that testing as well, and we came up with separate decks, and many people in New York all came up with separate decks from that process. Mm-hmm. This wasn't a group thing to build one deck. This was also this sort of testing where these decks were run through the gauntlet, played by very good players, and if you did have an idea and you wanted to run it through the system, then you could really sort of field test your deck, and that's a very, very important part of deck building, for which I'm very grateful to have been part of that.
For sure. I mean, Dan built physically somewhere of the upwards of 40 decks, proxies or with real cards, and it was amazing. Like, when I was down there, we were playing, I'd say I must have been getting in 25 games a day. So
that's testing. That's a perfect choice.
Yeah.
So you were playing a Targ Aloof and Apart, that was using sort of the dragons, some saves. You mentioned there was a summer module. Anything that stands out that you really want to?
It's the saves. The saves really make that deck. The ability to get the Ragal that can get all those dupes, the ability to use the Eerie, and these other saves make that deck so much more resilient than people think it's going to be, and it makes it very difficult for people to Valor you. It had some good tech against Maesters, because I was expecting both Bera and Martell Maesters. I didn't see any Martell Maesters.
Really did not see much Martell at all.
But it was running, King Vis, two of, and a couple of the army that actually, when you win a power challenge, you discard attachments. So that was kind of some of my anti-Maester tech to make sure that I could win those matches, as well as Dissensions from Martell. I thought it was a good call, and Martell really, really doesn't like Dissensions. They can't cancel what he calls it thinking. It discards a lot of their refugees, and I expected a lot more Martell.
Yeah, that certainly was maybe the story. Was we all expected more Martell, a lot more Martell, and it was not represented at all in the cuts, and there were some Martells at 4-2, obviously, but then that was a surprise to me, and that's clearly where we call things wrong. Apparently, we're good at calling things wrong for Gen Con.
Yeah, for sure. I was really happy that we called the DC decks that they were going to take almost exactly. I think we said we were going to see 2-3 Dragon Pit and the rest playing Bera, and that's exactly what happened.
That was cool.
Tell me about the games you played. Is there anything that stuck out? Any great plays? Any bad plays?
There certainly are. I'll start by mentioning the deck. So I was playing a Bera Knights, which I figured was, as I mentioned on the cast, it was an auto loss to Dragon Pit, and I was fairly certain there would be some Dragon Pit out there. But I've been having a lot of fun with this build. It has some neat little tricks hidden in it that, even if you expect there's not much you can do about it, there's so much you can do with that little Knight of the North and prioritizing power challenges with Bera's resilience that you can just work away at a game even when it's gone horribly against you. And then those Knights of the North are the linchpin to a bunch of other neat little tricks in the deck. So I really enjoyed this deck. in testing, I found that it actually had some plus matches that I really wasn't expecting it to have. And then I tried to tune it so that it could do something against Dragon Pit. And, you know, I added King's Law, and I liked that for other reasons as well. And, you know, that didn't help. Then I added other things, and that didn't help. It turns out that even a bad Dragon Pit paid by a bad player beats this deck. You can easily outnumber them with Knights if you're running Preston. Yeah, it's just, you know, you really need the stars to align to beat it. So this clearly wasn't going to be my tournament, but the deck was a lot of fun, and it performed very, very well. It was designed to completely destroy Martell, which never happened. So I had some very interesting matches. My very first match was actually against someone that we've mentioned on the cast before. This was the younger brother of the girl that you were talking about 2 years ago. Was playing in the tournament, and he was playing in that tournament 2 years ago as well. And he
the younger brother of the nine-year-old. So he's nine now?
I think that's about right, yeah. I think he might have been a little bit over that. He might have been 10, but in that vicinity. And this was my very first match, and at the end of turn one, I think he was 10 power, 11 power. I was in trouble. I did manage to turn that game around, but man, he came on strong there, and he was a lot of fun to play against, so I certainly wanted to mention him. And his sister was also playing in the tournament. I think
his sister did super well in Melee.
Yeah, that's right. She did excellently. But my matches overall, I went 4-2. My losses are the kind of losses I like. They're the kind of losses that I learned things from that were very interesting games. One was actually to Peter Wilson from Montreal. He was playing Stark Knights, so you know that matchup's going to be kind of a coin toss. And, you know, he set up more knights than I did, or set up same number of knights, but was able to march the wall, one of them on turn one, which I knew was going to happen. And actually, this Bera deck now with the Bitterbridge encampment can recover from that position. I wound up drawing a card a turn for 6 turns to his 3 cards a turn. I think I hit 13 power at one point. I just could not close the game drawing only a card a turn. And he played that very conservatively and very safely, knowing that the card weight would eventually crush me. But it wound up being a much more interesting matchup than you expect from a Stark Bera Knights sort of mirror where you think it's just a coin toss on turn one. Other matches that are worth mentioning, I played Kevin Shi, who was running a Bera Black Sails, which was his new take on the Rearminator, bringing back armies from the dead with See Who's Stronger and you know, No Shadows Ball, but being able to search out some of the pieces with Black Sails. It didn't quite get running. I was able to lock it out of influence as well, so that was comfortable. I played against a Stark defense deck as well, which was kind of interesting, with Sea Guard and Desolate Passage and things that actually made it quite hard to push challenges through. Then again, those Knights of the North are just money. So they really were the thing that he had trouble answering, and I had answers to his only answers to Knights of the North, so that wound up going my way. And then my other loss was to a Dothraki deck, and it wound up being a match where he just flooded the board, and I was winning power challenges, and eventually I made a play mistake where I didn't count a claim raise from one of my knights, and I hit 14, and then he finished at 15. But I was kicking myself afterwards, but really it was wholly because I had not played with the physical version of that card, and I'd played with the censored version on Octagon for so long, I forgot that if he's not participating in the challenge, he can still raise claim if you've got another Rainbow Guard. And that's a mistake that I really should have remedied with more games with the cards. And this is, I don't want to take anything away from my opponent. He played a stellar game, and I don't think that I deserve to win it in the end because I made that mistake. But this is something that I hadn't really quite realized was affecting my gameplay. And so I learned something from that match, which is always something good to have from a loss. But overall, that was, you know, there was 6 matches, 4 wins, 2 losses. I was in the 4-2 bracket alongside the 2014 World Joust Champion, Sam Bratz, the 2014 World Melee Champion. So it's a very good place to be.
4-2 is super respectable as a
It's worth noting they only did 6 rounds where they should have done 7. But I can't really complain about the way they ran the tournament. The time that it ended and all the other things wound up justifying the way it was run. And we knew beforehand, right? I can't say, oh, you know, I should have, you know, then had a chance to lose the match against Dragon Pit in the next round. You know, also knowing that the top 2 decks were going to be Dragon Pit, I knew that the cut was not going to be a friendly place for my deck. So I was quite happy with the end result and quite happy with being able to watch some of the cut matches as things went on and then get to celebrate quite a lot that evening.
Yeah, we did. It was pretty crazy. But before we get to the celebrations, I'll tell you about my day. I got to play extremely good players probably almost all day. I think in the Swiss, I probably played 5 of my 6 matches against people that I would consider very strong players with really good decks. And that's a lot of fun.
Come on, tell us who the sixth was.
Well, that would just be so nice. When I played a new DC player that I didn't know was from DC, fourth round, I guess. Fourth or fifth round. So he was doing extremely well. He was playing the DC Dragon Pit. And I didn't know he was from DC, and to the point where when he asked me after I had won the game, I just got off to this great start. I blew up his draw with Viserys, and basically from then I had draw and he didn't, and it was a losing match for him. But he played on, he played well, but he did do a few things that showed that he was a newer player, that he's only, I asked him, he told me he'd only been playing for about a year. And then he asked me what plots I had in my deck. So, you know, being the nice person I am, I told him. And then he asked me, you know, about other cards in my deck, and I just told him. I said, oh, this is how this works. This is one of my tricks. You know, I get a lot of people with this. And then afterwards, I saw him standing next to Corey, and I went, ah, spy! So it was just kind of funny. You know, obviously, I don't it's not a big deal if I told him these things. And he seemed like a really nice guy, and it was a fun match. But I just thought it was really funny that I didn't know that he was from D.C., and I basically told him my whole plot deck and all these little tricks about my deck. I got to play Steven Simoni round 2, and that's always a great match. You know, Steven is an excellent player who consistently makes the cut at all these major events in both Melee and Joust.
He made it this year, yeah.
Yeah, he made it this year again. I think he's always made the cut at Gen Con. Every single year he's gone for the 4 or 5 years that he's gone. You know, that's, to me, a telltale sign of a really strong player if they're consistently making the cut like that at those big events.
Oh, ouch, John. You hurt me.
Oh, it's okay. I think your world championship will make you feel better when you go
That's right.
Yeah, that trophy you buff every night. Oh yeah, world champion. And I think you consistently make the cut in all these events too, just because you have a one-off year. So I got to play Steve, and it was a good game, but I felt that I was doing super well in the challenge phases against him, and he was maybe playing the plot game a little bit better than me. I think he felt that he was really controlling the plot game, but there was a few times where, even though he was baiting me into use a plot, I felt that it was the correct play anyways, which is kind of a strange place to be, where both you and your opponent want you to play a certain plot. So, I don't know.
I know who to tell who was right.
Are you going to say the person that won?
Yeah.
Yes! So, that was a great game. But really, I felt that I was playing extremely well almost all day. All the way up, I think, until before the cut match. And I'm the type of player that starts to fade after about 5 games. I'm a little bit older, so I don't have the energy these young bucks do. So I start to get a little bit tired. I make more mistakes. And honestly, I hadn't had as many test games that I would normally like with a deck like this. In fact, I feel that the deck that I was playing could have actually used tweaking, and that's obvious by the fact that I made changes the night before. So I wasn't really comfortable with all the cards, especially some of the newer cards, and the one that I made a mistake with in the final game was the Eerie. So when you save a character with this, it removes the power from
that. So this was your final game before the cut?
Yeah, this is my final Swiss game. Yeah, it removes the power from that character. Now, I'd been using it to save dragons most of the day, so it didn't make a difference because I don't have any power. But I ended up playing Lauren, the nice lady who I had looked at the deck the night before in my drunken stupor and decided that who would ever play the HOD Solaire deck and do well with it. And, of course, our game was extremely, extremely close. She played fantastically. I mean, just excellent. Anticipated plots, knew when to control challenges, knew what to do, thought out her moves. You know, I hate to say this, but I think she played better than Steven Simoni.
Now you both
we'll cut that part. I love saying that. That's my joke. But she was really, really solid player, and her deck was way better than I anticipated. It was good because that meant it was surprising as well. We were back and forth, and Dave Danny, basically, who had some power on her with the Eerie and forgot to discard the power. You know, the next plot phase went around, and we were playing, and I managed to rush to victory. So we shake hands, and it was pretty stressful because it was, like, really close. It was whoever went first was going to get it. I had a Summer's Kings Road, and I had the 111-1, so I got to go first. I took the game with another renown on Danny. I actually got to 16 power. And then Kyle says, oh, like once we shake, he goes, you shouldn't have won. The power should have been discarded from Danny. And of course it's like, what? I shouldn't have won. And Lauren's like, what? He shouldn't have won. So she's like, can we go back? And I sit there and I think, like, would I have chosen a different plot? Would I have played differently? My challenge order? Like, it's not a go back, like, this challenge. It would be a go back to when Danny died, in my mind, right? Yeah. Because I think all the decisions after that would kind of been tainted. Because I picked that plot thinking I could go first to get the power, etc. So I called over Nate. And Nate said, did you guys end the game? And Lauren said, yeah, we ended the game. We shook hands. And then Kyle mentioned this. And Nate said, well, then the game's over. And the winner's decided. If you guys thought you ended the game is done. That's the rules. But he said, you know what? I don't want to force you to put in a win or a loss if you don't want to. So it's up to you at this point. And I thought about it. And I said, I have no idea. Like, I don't know how different things would have been. And I couldn't remember what she marshaled. So I, you know, it was hard for me to remember the board state at the time where Danny would have lost the power. So I said to her, let's flip a coin for it.
This is, I do want to mention, this is after you already won the game. I agree with Nate's ruling entirely. You can't go back. I would have had, if I'd remembered my claim raise, I would have had 15 power. That doesn't change anything once the game is over. I think this is very generous of you.
So she agrees. I let her call the flip. Someone gives us a coin. I flipped it, and I won the flip. Yes. And then after that, after all that, someone comes up to me and goes, you know she had a prize character on the board? And I said, yeah. I said, well, you won the challenge with 3 dragons. You could have just killed that 2-strength prize. So even if you didn't have your renown on Danny, you would have won anyways. And I went, oh, okay. Well, I don't feel as bad. You know, like, it's not, but man, it was just such a weird state to be in. It'll definitely be memorable. And, you know, I hope to play Lauren in the future. She was an excellent player. I think we're going to see her again. And in fact, I hope to have the opportunity to build with her, because I think the way she thinks about the game is at a higher level than a lot of other players. Because, again, she had that surprising deck that was really good. So that would be nice. So then I made the cut. Promptly flopped 2 cards. One of the main reasons I went with this deck was that it sets up 4 more cards 99.7% of the time, and just didn't seem to like me that game. I actually drew every single one of my events and all my characters over 4 cost. The first one allowing me to actually set up 0 cards, which is like, the chance of that is astronomically small. I mulliganed into a 2-card setup. And on top of that, my opponent had a decent setup, one of the cards being Mira. And when he won his challenge with Lewin, he got a Call of the Three-Eyed Crow so that he could actually save Lewin and bring him back into play. And it was just downhill from then. I think I played 1 more plot and then shook his hand. It was very depressing. But Tyler went on for the next thing. He was playing Darkwing Stark Words. He's a good player. He's from Florida. I think he normally wins the regional there with some form of Stark pretty consistently. So I was happy to lose to a good player that continued on, and I think he lost the next round. But overall, I was extremely happy with the fact that I made the cut both days, that I think I didn't get below 11th either day, which was nice, and I'm probably somewhere in the top standings just below the DC guys. If we were to do overall. So you can't complain about that.
No, you certainly can't. So I know you have this other segment. We're going to cut that in fairly shortly to describe the overall winning deck and the process of that winning deck. But just to give you guys the end result in very brief, it wound up being a Dragon Pit versus Dragon Pit final. Played Aaron Broderick versus Pat Reynolds, both from DC. Aaron Broderick being sort of the architect of that deck, who's really adapted it over the season. And Patrick Reynolds, who didn't lose a game all day playing that deck. So obviously you'll hear more about that shortly.
Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. Today we're joined by a very special guest. We're joined by, we're going to say DC Aaron. I think it's the good Aaron now, though, since you always place higher than him in all the major events. And He is the mastermind, or one of the masterminds, behind the deck that took Gen Con recently in the Joust. He placed second overall in the Joust tournament as well, which is not too shabby, I hear. And he's hopefully going to tell us a little bit about not just his own Joust experience, but the experience of some of the people he worked with on this deck and played with in the events, which was the DC meta, which did extremely well this Gen Con. I think you guys got, you had three of the final four in the Melee. You had three out of the top four in Joust. And then I think if you took a look at the overall stats, you were probably you had three people in the top six as well, and all of them on the top part of that top six.
Yeah, it was a pretty good weekend for us all.
Can you tell us a little bit, like, leading up to Gen Con, how did you guys go about picking your decks? What made you choose Dragon Pit?
Well, going up to Gen Con, we had two big tournaments. We had the New York Regional and then the DC Regional. I didn't play in the DC Regional. I just played in New York. So I played a version of the Dragon Pit there. Got to the semifinals, and I lost a mirror match to Pat, which is kind of a preview of my Gen Con experience. And so we played it. We knew it was, like, probably one of our top two or three decks, but we were going to wait to see what happened with the fact. And so Seth Lowe, who is another one of our meta, went and won the DC regional with the Worship deck. And I think he went 9-0 or something like that. So that deck got pretty nerfed in the most recent fact. So we were just kind of waiting to see what would happen and then kind of go from there. It's like the Dragon Pit deck didn't really get hit at all. It didn't change at all. And the things that got restricted actually helped it quite a bit, I think. You know, a Rattering Mirror was quite good. You know, having Harry come on or go on the restricted list was actually really good for the Dragon Pit deck. So a lot of things sort of fell into place. So then I think we were testing. We were trying to find lots of things that would beat the Dragon Pit. And then we were also coming up with this Baron Maesters build that Seth and Corey kind of came up with. Actually, Steve played the original version of that at the DC regional. And that deck was interesting because it was actually a counter to the Worship deck. Originally, it was running, I think, Fleeing in Dry Season as sort of like a Worship hoser. But so it kind of got changed around. So then we had those two decks that were there, and we were testing and trying to build decks that really beat them. And those kind of became our two finalists, you would say.
Yeah, so I know you have a ton of experience with the Dragon Pit that, you know, you said that, you know, you ran it in New York, but you were actually one of the principal builders of that deck as well, right? You're the one that kind of took the more standard Dragon Pit and decided to add that influence module. And really, I think that actually made the Dragon Pit pop. It made it way more effective in my mind than the non-influence version that a lot of people were running. But I think there's some hard choices in the restricted for Dragon Pit, because you see that the Euros are running Fear. You guys ran Preston. Other people run different restricted. So what made you guys choose Preston over the other plethora of restricted cards you could have chosen?
Well, okay, that's a good question. We liked Preston for a variety of reasons. Our Dragon Pit was built with sort of a Greyjoy, I would say, idea in mind, in that there was just a lot of really hard-to-kill characters, which gave you a lot of long game when you're able to use the opponent's Velar or any other reset against them. So Preston is a great thing for that. You know, you can put not just Preston back in the shadows, you can put Boris back in the shadows, you can put Jamie back in the shadows, so you can actually save two characters before, like, an obvious Velar. It obviously triggers King's Landing, which is a huge thing. And then it also has a lot of sort of nasty tricks that you can do if you don't have any cards in shadows. Especially if you're playing things like Shadow Parasite or something like that, you can change the challenge dynamics quite a bit. So, I mean, I guess the other options, you could play Fear, and I think Fear was probably, like, I didn't see the deck list for that version, but I would imagine that it's similar to, like, the Hollow Hill build that ran Fear, that had, you know, sort of like a plot succession that was really hard to get around, and then having the threat actually be better out of that build than Hollow Hill. I guess other restricteds that you could do, I don't know what else you would probably, I mean, I've seen Hatchling's Feast, but that's not especially good because you have to get three.
Yeah, that's too much.
Influence. So I would say, yeah, usually, you know, Preston was big. So I guess those are the big reasons we thought of Preston.
I've seen Danny in some of these pit decks as well as a restricted choice, just to help remove the bigger characters, those big armies.
Yeah, I mean, I could see, obviously, Danny's a great card. I just don't, with the B being restricted, I don't know how good of a card Danny is right now, just because there's not a lot of ways to recur. So I think that's why we probably took her out, I guess, after the fact.
Yeah, and that's really one of the DC deck building philosophies, right, is that you try to go for efficient over fragile. So even if a card might have a bigger swingy effect, you'd rather have the more consistent effect in general, I think. That's one of the things I see from your meta a lot of the time. And I think this pit really showed that. But we also tested a lot of pit, actually. You're a very close version of the deck. Like you said, you brought it to New York, so we had seen it. We tested a lot against it. And one of the things we found, and one of the reasons we didn't choose it as one of our decks, is that it was very hard for a new player to pilot for a long period of time, because a lot of the games went long. It was a long game deck. It was grindy, and it actually took a lot of decision points. There was a lot of little tricks, like you were mentioning earlier. And I think it's amazing that, you know, not one but two of you piloted this all the way through the tournament without making those key play mistakes that can cost you a game later on. Myself, I usually start to fade around my 10th game. So, and, you know, I hear people refer to Brian as the robot. Sorry, Patrick as the robot. I don't know why I said Brian. Patrick is the robot because he just plays consistently all the time. But you're like that, too. You always play a very strong, consistent game. I remember I was joking to you that the only curse you had was that you couldn't beat a Canadian and that you broke it, which was too bad because that was all that was holding you back.
I remember you saying that.
Yeah. So, I mean, outside of this, you know, the magic curse, you and Patrick both play this fantastic long game. So this is a deck that wouldn't tell a new player to go net deck this and play pit for a big tournament, because I just think it's grueling. How did you guys prepare for that? Like, did you prepare for that, or do you just always, you never get tired and you're just, you know, a perfect game all the time?
No, I mean, we definitely prepared. I mean, it definitely takes, like, like, you want to make, like, see all the plays and have them not have to be something you really have to figure out. Like, you want to be able to see those plays kind of like a turn ahead. So it does take a lot of practice and experience to pilot it, I think, efficiently. You know, there's, I don't know, I guess the way we prepare it is we just, you know, we play a Corys. So, you know, if you go and play a Corys and you go, you know, if you win 50% of your games and you feel like you've won Worlds. So, I mean, So it's good against that because you start to see like how important the minor details, you know, like one example of something like that is, you know, like Mirani's Fighting Pit. That's the name of it. Yeah. The reduced by three. Mm-hmm. And so, and how important it is to like always have more uniques than your opponent. And so a lot of times, like, you'll get a play where somebody will, you'll be like two uniques to two uniques, and somebody will come in for an intrigue that you can't stop. And you're holding a Flame Fist. And so oftentimes, like, the play there is not to stop the intrigue, but to actually off the unique character so you can stop the rest of the challenges. And so it's, I think it's things like that. Like, you're always monitoring, like, the unique count and being able to do it if that card is on the table. I think another big thing is just realizing that Forever Running, that's like one of the key cards in the deck, can just own so many different challenges and can be played in so many different ways that you can see kind of how that can interact with a lot of the different, a lot of the game.
Yeah, for sure. Those strength bumps are so key. So just to not talk about the pit deck too much, I want to talk a little bit about the Baron Maesters that you guys also took. I saw that you actually had more people playing the Baron Maesters than the pit. Is that because the Maesters are a little bit more easy to play, in your opinion, for a long game? Because personally, that's what I feel. I feel that the I took Baron Maesters to Worlds. I'm not saying it's an easy deck to play. I think when you compare it to Pit, because of the length of every game with Pit, that the Maesters can, you know, they can finish in two plots sometimes. They just rush with power. You know, give Knight of the Flower an intrigue icon or something, and man, that guy claims a lot of power.
I don't know exactly why everybody picked it. I think we had been testing those two decks against each other quite a bit, and we had kind of gotten that matchup down to understanding exactly how that would work. I think the consensus was that you'd have a lot more easy games, like you said, with the Baron Maesters. And so you'd get a lot of games where you'd win by turn two. I think Steve had a record of, like, he think he won a game in like 5 minutes or something like that, Baron Maesters. And he came back and he was very proud that he was first done. And so I think that that's kind of the mentality behind that deck. And I think a lot of times people also don't test against a lot of Maesters decks, so they don't see, like, how, you know, just keeping one challenge from going through can really swing the game. Mm-hmm. And it's, I don't like playing the deck because I feel like if I miss one trigger or one thing, then I can really get owned by it, my own decisions.
So, absolutely. I think that's key, actually, is that you have less decisions because the games are over faster, but every single one of them matters a little bit more, which can be tough.
Yeah, we were definitely at the end there. Everybody was kind of like trying to figure out how to get a little edge like between the two decks. And so, you know, like in my deck, I had actually teched in two Myrnes Brothels for Maesters and for Direwolves, which I thought Direwolves are actually a really big problem for the Dragon Pit deck. If you can get like sort of the Wizard Tower on one of your, like a Stark Maesters or something like that, or if you can get just even a Stark No Agenda. So I was really worried about Grey Wind and like, you know, Viserys being my only answer to Grey Wind and Shaggy Dog, because then that threat is just working against me. So I was really concerned about that going into the tournament.
Yeah, we had tested a Stark Tower Direwolf that did very well, but didn't end up being one of our top decks in the end. Definitely thought I was going to see more of it, and I didn't until my top 16, and then that was a DW that just happened to have the Wolves out early. So tell us a little bit about your tournament. You lost at least one game. Did you lose any others?
No, I didn't. I lost the finals. I didn't have a bye, so I first game I played Martell No Agenda, which is usually an easy game for the Dragon Pit, but actually turned out to be probably one of my hardest games for a variety of reasons. One, I think I made a couple of misplays. Like I put Preston out in Marshling and he was promptly Yigritted, which is not good. And then he put down Doran Solar. So there's like challenge phases where I couldn't make a military or an intrigue challenge. So I was trying to work around that. But in the end, I got him in the end, but it was a close game. Then I beat a couple Stark decks, and then I beat Jerry Crane's Greyjoy No Agenda deck.
That had actually off.
Yes. He had one of, I think, the play of the tournament from the games that I was in, where he had a Mercoro on the board and a Scurvy Cutthroat on the board. So I flame kissed the Mercoro. He saved it with the Mercoro, and then the same response window Scurvy Cutthroated the flame kissed off and ended up saving his Mercoro from the flame kissed. I was like, this is like a crazy interaction. But like the fact that he saw it, I was pretty impressed. So that was a pretty cool. And then fifth round, I played Seth, and we somehow, like, Seth and I, we had like this game where we were just calculating every single move, and we ended up in a 7-7 draw somehow. We were just way overthinking the game. And then sixth round, I played Chad, who was playing like a Stark Maester Tower, and then I think he knew he was going to make the cut, so he actually played his Maesters without any chains on his house, and I think to test like if it could beat my deck and not have to play the whole Maester game with it. Mm-hmm. But that was not the strategy, so I ended up getting a Mogwin there. So I ended up being second seed, and so I played Seth second. I played Seth in the top 16, and that was probably the best game of the tournament. For me, because we had, like, I don't know if, did you talk, I don't know if you talked to Seth about the whole, like, first plot conversation that we had had?
No, I didn't. I'd be interested to hear it.
So, like, we had come to the conclusion, like, we had played all these plots, and we knew, like, the first turn was so important. So there was a lot of discussion as to, like, should you play first turn threat out of pit if you had a Shadows card on setup, or should you play the 3-6-1 at the beginning? And so the consensus generally was that if you played threat and Baromaesters played Forgotten Plans with a Maester in hand, then the Baromaesters were probably going to win. If Baromaesters played at the gates into threat, then Dragon Pit was at a decided advantage. So there was a lot of mind games. It was sort of like playing chicken in the beginning. So I ended up getting a very strange draw. I didn't get any Shadows first time, so I mulligan. I didn't get any Shadows the second time. So I was sitting there with no Shadows and really no plays, you know, to make. So I'm like, what do I do? So I look, you know, across and I see that he has a Seat of Power and a Narrow Sea, and I had like all one cost locations. So I decided to play City Besieged turn one to try to like stem the, you know, onslaught of, you know, eight characters that are going to come my way that I know they're coming. And I sort of thought I had lost the match at this point, because I thought if he plays Forgotten Plans now, then he has a Maester, or even if he plays out the gates right now, then I'm probably hosed. But he ends up playing Aftermath, because I don't believe he had a Maester, and he was trying to play the long game thinking I would threat. So it ended up having that he won a bunch of challenges, but he didn't get any chains off. So then we were playing the chicken game the second turn. I ended up playing City of Soldiers And I had gotten a card in the Shadows with them, so I was able to off as a Shy Initiate, and he thought I was going to play Threat, so he played Forgotten Plans.
Now you're laughing inside, right? Because he's blown his best defense, and you're still good to go.
It was not a bad thing to happen for my part. And then another bad thing happened for him was that he got out of like a Brightwater Man at Arms, and he had some other character. And I brought Youngerth out of Shadows, and so he was able to come in with the Brightwater. I was able to jump in a Dragon Thief, which claim soaked. And kept Young Griff, and I had a City of Shadows on board. So I was able to two claim Intrigue and two claim Mill back, which wiped his board, and he didn't have any chains off. And then after that, it was pretty hard for him to come back because I think he was forced to play Mill's Scheme before I had played Valar. So I think he knew kind of at that point it was probably not going to go well. But he played it out. I mean, he definitely, the best, or if not one of the best, players, in the United States right now. So he is, is always an honor to, play Seth and he just didn't, if he would have gotten one Maester on that first turn, it's very likely that he could have won. So it was a very close match.
Yeah, sometimes those matches that don't look close are actually all about one card or a bad setup and, the tables would turn. So outside of the Joust, what was your Gen Con like? What was your experience? How was it like, working with the DC guys? But you also played Melee and did pretty decent. So you guys had decided to take a Greyjoy unopposed Melee deck, I think.
I just played a Dragon deck because I didn't have all the cards for either one of those decks.
Okay.
So I just put together a Dragon deck, and the only big changes I put in were Horse Gate, which was huge. That card is probably should be restricted in Melee. And it just raised the claim. So having like 2-3 claim power challenges is just ridiculous. One of the best games of the tournament was when I sat down at my first table and there was Will Lentz, I believe, was sitting there. And there was a girl named, I believe her name was Caitlin, who was 12. And Caitlin was no joke at this game. Like, she came with a Stark, no agenda, with a lot of direwolves, like a direwolf tower deck. And while she didn't win the game, she definitely had the most control over the game. And we had going around, and she ended up just ruining rules day that game. It was just really sad to see, her just to be able to, like, decide that he was going to lose. And happy for me, really. But
I heard she went on to win her second table.
Did she? Yeah, she was really great. Like, she knew the rules and she knew the time structure and she was not playing around. So I will not look forward to seeing her at a table in the near future.
So we were at the final table together, our final table, which was the top 16. What was your record going into that table?
I had one win and like a second with 14 power and then a second with 12 power.
Okay, so very respectable. So we played our top 16 match. You were absolutely horrible to me. You wouldn't even trade plots. It made me cry inside. But your great performance in both the Melee and the Joust, I think, placed you like somewhere close to first, second, or third overall, right? Like, it wasn't official this year. They didn't have the calculations.
Yeah, but I think that's right. We were sort of calculating it in our heads, and we aren't sure exactly how the scoring would work. I don't know, because I think Rick finished second at his table, and I finished second at our table. But I think he was higher seed, so I'm not exactly sure how that all worked out. But, either way, I felt like it was a good tournament, so it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, it was fun. That was, I think that's the most important thing. And actually, it looked like you guys were having more fun this year than in previous years. Y'all came out, you sang some karaoke, the DC meta did, drank some beers, celebrated your victory. And it was great because you guys were there with the rest of the community instead of sequestered away somewhere. And I thought that was really great. And I think it's awesome to... Anytime the whole Thrones community can get together, I think it's just a really great thing. Is there any specific piece of Gen Con, the deck, or your experience you want to talk about?
I mean, I just, I probably should give a shout out to testing meta to, testing with Corey and Seth and Patrick. And obviously we should talk a little bit about Patrick, who actually won the whole thing.
Yeah, but I heard he's recharging because he's a robot. Yeah.
What's funny is because everybody talks about, like, they see him in the tournaments, and he's one of those players that gets better throughout the tournament. He doesn't get worse.
Yeah. He's nervous the first round, and then he gets into his zone, and it's over.
Yeah, it's exactly, that's how it is. And so, like, he's just rolling. But, like, you know, if you meet him outside of the tournament, he's just the nicest guy. So
I tried to talk to him in the tournament. Like, well, he was clearly winning. His game was over. And I was like, you know, how's it going and stuff? And he, like, he was still, like, he was so in it. I don't even think he knew I was talking to him. He was just like, you know, I'm at 14 power. This guy's at zero, and I need this last power, which is going to be this challenge. And I'm not talking to anyone until this challenge is finished, you know? It was just the look of intensity. It was great. And then Seth just came up to me and said, he's a robot. He can't hear you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously we're feeding the whole, you know, mystery of Patrick Reynolds going through this whole thing, but it's pretty awesome that that's how it's coming out.
No, I think that's what I'm going to call him from now on. I like to give nicknames to people that come on the show. And in fact, for those that don't come on the show, so I'm just going to call him Patrick the Robot Reynolds. Seth's doing it as well, so I think the name stuck.
Yeah, I was joking with him that I felt like the pen to his teller. As we were, I'm always like the one having to represent him. Like, I think the deal is if I ever beat him like at a final table in a tournament,
he'll come on.
He's going to have to do the podcast, so.
That would be great. That'd be funny and great. Are you going to Worlds?
I think I am. I just started a new job, so I'm trying to make it all work. You know how like starting a new job and taking time off can be. So I'm actually starting on Monday, so we'll kind of see how that goes, but I'm going to definitely make an effort to go.
I won't be making myself, so I wish you the best of luck since I won't be there to play against you. And I hope DC performs well and gives a good challenge. So we'll DC be moving into 2.0, or are you going to finish off this year in 1.0 and then reassess the meta at that point to see if you guys will be joining, playing in 2.0?
I'm pretty sure we're going to be playing in 2.0. I would say that our focus is probably going to be 1.0 throughout Worlds, but there was a lot of buzz, you know, everybody getting the new cards and kind of taking them out. You could see people, you know, start to think of things to do. And so I wouldn't be surprised if there's a pretty strong showing in 2.0 as well, especially early. But I think it'll be good. We were kind of saying that it was a really great tournament. We were really happy it went really well. But like both of our decks, neither of them had any cards from the new cycle. And there's so many cards and there's just so many things and there's so many established archetypes that it's kind of just time for a recharge in my opinion. But so I think it'll be a happy end to Thrones 1.0 and then we'll be transitioning on to 2.0.
Yeah, I mean, I love 1.0, but I totally agree with you. It's a little bloated. There's some really strong archetypes that are established, and it's hard for FFG to mitigate that without destroying the meta, which is a good meta right now, I think.
Yeah.
But well, thank you so much for coming on the show and talking to us about your Gen Con deck that you took second with. And, of course, Patrick the Robot Reynolds, who won it all going 10-0, which is just – I think that's the first time ever that the person who was undefeated in Swiss also won the whole event. So that's a good pat on the back to Patrick if he's listening to this. And you did awesome, man. Like, just, it's so hard to make the cut in these big events. Doing it both Jost and Melee, you know, getting first or second overall is a huge accomplishment that you should be proud of. And it actually saddens me a little bit that they don't still have an overall title because those two games are very different, in my opinion. It's a different skill set. And to achieve so well in both of them like you did should be rewarded.
Well, thank you very much. It's very kind of you to say. And, you know, I mean, a lot of kind reviews, so I appreciate that.
We'll talk about the aftermath of the Joust.
Whoa, what a party. We went back to Casablanca, the bar that's attached to the Microtel. We were there with about probably 30 other Thronesers, and we closed the place out.
I think someone had to bribe them to keep the bar open late.
I believe people did, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. This was, we started there. People were trickling in as they were leaving the con, grabbing some food, grabbing some drink. The poor overworked stewardess, or not stewardess, sorry, waitress on her first day back on the job with the big crowd coming in that they were not ready for. But we kept the karaoke open hours after it was supposed to close. We kept the bar open hours after it was supposed to close. People, the DC folks trickled in after their win as well, so we got to toast the victors, which was a lot of fun. There are actually videos of the karaoke.
John Bruno came by. So even the Thronesers that don't drink came by, had some karaoke, had some food, hung out, chatted with us. That was great. It was, it's so great to have the community like that. Some of us, drank a little too much, a couple boat races, some shots. Some people had to head back home to their hotel.
Yeah, that evening went really, really well. I think a lot of us enjoyed that. We also knew that we didn't have to get up as early the next day. The Kingslayer wasn't starting till later. There was a lot more time to get in. So some people went out to check out another bar afterwards, despite the fact that things were still going fairly strong in the first one. And then people trickled in from everywhere. And I think only one person the next day was a no-show, a casualty of war.
Simone died. Yeah, I had a fantastic breakfast with a bunch of Thronesers the next day instead of making Kingslayer. It's kind of a ritual that we go to this Perkins place and have these scrambled eggs or omelets and stuff that they do, and chose to do that instead of make the Kingslayer. And gave me a chance to walk the dealer hall, which was great too, because Gen Con has so much going on. And I actually got to play a bunch of Kingslayer, a bunch of 2.0 at night, so I didn't feel as gung-ho as some people to do it, since I had just been doing it all night.
I managed to get into the Kingslayer. I had, obviously, my tickets, and I'd actually picked up two cores the previous day in between rounds of the Joust. I got quite lucky, so I have a full playset now. But for me, the Kingslayer was just... I knew beforehand I wasn't going to play all the rounds. For me, I was really interested in meeting some new players that had never played the game before, watching them play. Obviously, I've quite a stake in this game. Not financially or anything like that. Obviously, I would disclose that if that were the case. But I was heavily involved in the creation. You can see my name on the editing credits for the rules. So I really wanted to see how the game played out in practice in people's hands. It was the first time I got to see the cards. And even the very first day when we were playing in the melee, I got to see some players who were from other LCGs but had never played Thrones before playing for the first time, and it was working and it wasn't breaking and they seemed to mostly get it, which was very, very encouraging. And that's what the Kingslayer was for me. I played three games. I got to play Matt Way, who completely destroyed me. I won my other two matches, but the other two were against players who were new to the game, and I got a chance to teach them some of the aspects of the game. And hopefully not, destroy them too much so that they definitely came back. I mean, actually, my third opponent, I told her, I'm leaving after this round, so have the win. The cards will start to go against me at the end, I'm sure. And she said, well, actually, I'm leaving after this round as well, so let's play it out. So we did. But I think overwhelmingly the response to that tournament was very good. There were a lot of people who played sort of three or four rounds and then they needed their chance to wander the dealer hall, which is what I did as well. But some people stuck around all the way to the final cut. The final cut had a lot of people whose names you would recognize from 1.0 that are just consistently good players. People like Greg Atkinson, like some of the Montreal crew, both Alex Skolnovich and Salim wound up meeting in the finals. It's also worth mentioning that Rob St. John's from Toronto recorded matches from the Kingslayer Top Cut, so there are actually quite a few of those that he's posted on his YouTube channel. While playing in them himself, exactly. So it's, he should not have played that little finger. I mentioned that in the post. So if you want to have a look at what that Kingslayer tournament was like, what those deck building rules played out as, there's certainly a place to get your first 2.0 fix there. But yeah, for me that day was mostly Dealer Hall, a quieter evening, I think, for us both.
Which was actually still awesome, because we just played games in the bar this time, so we didn't party hard. We still had a food, drink, but lesser quantities. Actually,
this is worth mentioning. So for those of you who've never, we mentioned it earlier in the cast, we're a bunch of Thrones players. So we take this very simple game called Sheriff of Nottingham. And we rules lawyered the shit out of that game.
People kept telling me what I was doing was breaking the game.
They had to call a judge. They had to call me in. had to work out the intricacies.
Like, John's not allowed to do that. It's like, there's three rules.
So that was definitely very, very Thrones community-wise, which is a lot of fun. It was a quieter evening, but there was still some karaoke. There was still some singing. It ended a little bit earlier. At least it did for me. And the Sunday was a quiet day. We went into the con for a little bit. We played your first Lord of the Rings match ever.
Which I enjoyed.
In the Fellowship event, and then tried a rematch in the airport. But just as things were going our way, we got called aboard. Curse those planes.
Yeah. Played some Mage Wars and Doom Town and stuff.
I played some Mage Wars with the Dutch. If I were to list all the people who were important in making this weekend awesome, the list would just keep going. And so I'm sort of hesitant to do any name shout-outs. Knowing that I can really only do one Gen Con and Worlds, I was very, very happy alternating. But this Gen Con, this staying in the Microtel thing, this regrouping all the Thrones players in one place that way, but also having the rest of the convention around, I'm leaning towards making Gen Con my event. I mean, Worlds is changing and getting better every year, and all the Thrones players all go to the same bar. You get a lot of the same great things out of it. But I don't know, the con was just a blast.
Yeah, it's just so good. And it's so much fun for all these different reasons you were saying, Alex.
So do we have a take-home message from Gen Con?
Come join us at the Microtel next year.
Come join us at the Microtel next year. Next year will be 2.0. It'll be a whole different beast. 2.0 Melee. It'll be the first big 2.0 Melee event.
Yes, I can't wait.
Well, no, not the first. Obviously, there's a side event at Worlds that is a Melee event, and there's going to be lots of tournaments in next year that I'm sure will have big Melee events.
That's not the same thing, though.
Closing comments, John. That went rather long. What do you have for us this week?
Got a tournament happening in Switzerland. I think it's their... Sweden?
Yeah, it's the Swedish... Well, it's the Nordic champions, so the Swedes are playing, but it's happening in Denmark in Copenhagen.
Exactly, that's what I was saying.
That's what you were saying.
Oh, I think some Spanish players are going to be there, too. I think...
Aoria
and his girlfriend.
Okay, and Ingrid as well. She's Swedish, so it's not that surprising that they would go out there to dominate even those tournaments, as exceptional players as they are.
Dominate. We got some serious big guns over there. We got the giant underpants in the house.
We do. And in fact, the Swedes specifically mentioned, and we mentioned this 2 weeks ago on the cast, that they were going to this tournament. It doesn't have quite the support that they'd expect from the Nordic Nationals in the future because of the way the other ones like X-Wing and so on, I think Conquest and Netrunner, get to send their champion to Worlds, but the Thrones one doesn't. But they're sort of making a push to go anyway to have enough players there so that they can sort of dictate terms for next year, which is a good forward-thinking philosophy, which means that they're not going to be at the Polish Fleabottom Freka, which is this weekend as well in Warsaw, which we had someone come on and talk to us about that 2 weeks ago, including the fact that there was going to be a mystery prize, which I look forward to seeing because that Men of Pride from last year I thought was a phenomenal prize idea, and I'm sure they're going to outdo themselves again this year. If you can quickly book your flight and head to Warsaw, do so. It sounds like it's going to be a blast there. And I do know there's going to be some 2.0 cores there, so if you haven't had a chance to look at them yet or play with them yet, I know that the Dutch were actually going to Warsaw, and they were going to bring along some cores as well.
Awesome.
Other closing comments? I think we should mention what's sort of coming up for the cast.
Yeah, we're going to switch gears and become more focused on 2.0. We're going to take a section each week from now on, I think, to focus on newer players because we think there's going to be a big influx for at least a couple months.
Well, we're all newer players at this point. But
true,
I know what
but
you
I mean.
Like
the basic
terminology and vocabulary and introducing people to the community and what Stalic is, for instance, something that, you know, Thrones players should know, that there's a tournament every year in a castle in Europe attended by enormous droves of Thrones players. This is worth noting.
Yeah.
So that kind of stuff. So at least a short back to basics kind of segment every week. And also some deck building.
Yes, lots of deck building.
Because we don't know what we're doing yet with decks.
No, so we're going to learn together.
Exactly. We will still be playing 1.0. We will still be playing 1.0 to help our friends test for Worlds and the like. And if you want to send us deck lists, we'll be happy to look over that kind of stuff. But we're kind of probably gradually shifting over so that the cast will be primarily 2.0 transition over the next 2 months or so with, obviously talking about 1.0 at Worlds and Stalic. There's no way we're skipping that.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Wall. If you have any comments or would like to be featured on the cast, please let us know by email at beyondthewallpodcast@gmail.com or through Facebook at Beyond the Wall Podcast. If you've enjoyed the music, check out more of Antti Martikainen's work at the link embedded in the chapter data. See you all next week.
Now, normally we don't actually record a segment as an Easter egg, but John, this news was just too good to pass up on.
It was. So we forgot to announce Canadian Nationals. So the AGOT Canadian Nationals is happening next weekend in Vancouver during an anime convention, and they capped it, Alex.
You mean they capped attendance?
Yeah, they want to make sure that they have enough room for all their different games. So there won't be more than 16 players for AGOT.
Well, we knew there wouldn't be more than 16 attending anyway.
That's kind of what the people that were complaining said, though some of them have written FFG and they might get something changed. Star Wars did. They wrote in and they complained about the fact that it was capped at 16 because they had capped all their nationals, I guess, at this really low number. And what they did was that all the people had planned their trips to go to Vancouver and fly in or drive up for the Sunday or Saturday it was held at. So they moved the days to Friday, and all these people had their planes coming in, can't even plane it now, and they're pretty pissed.
Oh, blame Canada.
Yeah, this time it's our fault.
Well, this is the distributor. This is Lion Rampart, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's... The fact that they would even cap a national event at 16, I mean, the fact that they put it in probably one of the worst places in Canada for Game of Thrones, and they decide this is where we're going to put the national.
Well, can they even recover the cost of the kit with 16 people?
I don't think so.
That's probably just a dead break even. Wonderful. Wonderful.
If they had just gone to the other side of Canada, they would have got 20 or 30 people, because I know that the Maritimes actually have some play groups.
Yeah. Yeah, they do.
And if they would have stuck it in Quebec, they probably would have had 30 or 40 like they did last year.
Yep. Well, that's funny and sad.
Sad. Yeah, it's sad.